This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
In the closing chapter of his latest book, Robert Jensen writes, "Pornography claims to take us on a path to a door that will open into more creative, erotic space, into imagination, into a garden of sexual delight. But it turns out that going through the pornographic door typically leads into a prison cell with four thick walls and no window. It is a dead end." Robert Jensen's latest book is titled Getting Off: Pornography and the End of Masculinity. It's an emotionally grueling and intellectually stimulating book with writing that combines personal and analytical dimensions, conveying immediacy and a sense of urgency. Robert Jensen has written books on the media, racism, and empire. He is a professor in the School of Journalism in Austin, Texas, and right now he's in Vancouver for a couple of public lectures on Monday and Tuesday, and we're very pleased he's been able to join us in the studio this morning. Welcome, Robert.
Great to be with you, Mordecai. Thanks for having me.
It was almost 30 years ago that women feminists initiated a vigorous campaign against the purveyors of pornography. In Vancouver, there were various protests, I remember, against the first video store that mainly marketed porn. It was called the Red Hot Video. What can you tell us about the period of anti-porn, that period of anti-porn analysis and activism?
Yes, for many years in the United States and in places like Canada as well, the argument about pornography was really between moralistic conservatives, usually rooted in a religious tradition, and liberals who argued for sexual freedom. That debate was really exploded in the late 70s and early 80s by feminists who looked at pornography not from a moralistic point of view, but as a question of power and a question of men's oppression of women. And one of the places in the culture where men's violence against women is reinforced and deepened. The primary figure in that was Andrea Dworkin in the United States, who in the late 70s started asking a simple question: why do we live with epidemic levels of sexual violence in our society? And not surprisingly, Andrea looked at the storytelling. You know, the way we understand ourselves in any culture comes from the stories we tell. And of course, in this culture, we're talking about mass media as the primary storyteller. So Andrea, focusing not only on pornography, but also mainstream media, started to look at the ways in which those stories reinforce a sense of men's domination over women and justify and legitimate men's violence against women. The pornography industry at that point, again, the late 70s, early 80s, was very small compared to today. But I think Andrea saw deeply into the genre and realized that the core of pornography, again, here we're talking about a commercial, mass-marketed, mass-media genre. We're not talking about any potential sexual expression. We're talking about a specific mass-mediated product in the world today. Andrea saw that the core of that was a dynamic of domination and subordination, that men's domination and women's subordination was being sexualized or eroticized. In the 30 years since that analysis originally emerged, we've seen more and more evidence that, in fact, the feminist critique was accurate. We've seen a dramatic expansion of pornography, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the level of overt cruelty and degradation against women that the industry puts on film.
Well, what would you use as markers for this notion that pornography, rather than maintaining even the level of presence that it had in our culture 30 years ago, has in fact expanded and become more normalized, quote unquote?
Well, there's several markers of this. One, of course, is legal changes. The obscenity laws in the United States are almost never enforced. Society has accepted that mass media genre in a certain way. By that, I don't mean, of course, that there are no people objecting. But you can see that the ability to make money from pornography has sort of paved the way for a kind of mainstream acceptance. You can see it in the just the raw numbers, the growth of the industry. Estimates there in the United States alone, something probably between $10 and $15 billion a year spent on pornography. And of course, all of this is going forward in a technological environment in which more and more people have more and more readily accessible pornography available to them, including increasingly younger people. So the internet, home recorders and DVDs and videos, all of that has made it technologically possible to expand. We see that social mores change and the legal response changes. So what you have in the United States today, and this is true to some degree of Canada as well, I think, as well as much of Western Europe, a kind of acceptance of pornography as part of the mainstream pop culture. You see this in the way that pornography performers will show up on mainstream news and entertainment shows. Jenna Jameson, one of the most famous, probably the most famous porn star in U.S. history, at one point had a best-selling book on the New York Times list. There's just been a slow move in which pornography has become more part of the mainstream. And at the same time, mainstream pop culture has become increasingly pornographic. So if you look at both of those trends, pornography coming into the center of the culture and the traditional pop culture, by that we mean network television, Hollywood movies, becoming increasingly pornographic, borrowing the codes and conventions of pornography. At this point, when I talk to young people, that means anybody younger than me, of course, and I'm 50. So, but when I talk to my students, people my son's age, teenagers, early 20s, they've grown up in a world where pornography is so commonplace that they often don't even think to question it. It's just part of the cultural landscape into which they were born and raised.
In your book, you speak of a rape culture that isn't even recognized as rape. Could you?
Yeah, one of the disturbing aspects of the levels of sexual violence in contemporary American culture, and I don't want to assume that Canada is always like the U.S., although I think there are some common themes here, is not only the level of violence, but the degree to which that violence is invisible. So, for instance, in the 1980s, there was a study released in which a number of women whose self-description of experiences they had met the legal definition of rape. And I don't remember the statistics off the top of my head, but something like a third of those women did not identify themselves as rape victims, even though their own experience met that legal definition. Perhaps more chilling is men often engage in activity that they self-report that meets the legal definition of rape, and they are adamant that they have not raped. And men often, in fact, are very blunt in saying they intend to engage in the same behavior in the future. So you have a level of sexual violence, and we're not talking about gray areas here. We're talking about acts that meet the legal definition of rape, which are not even recognized by rape by a significant minority of the victims and a majority of the perpetrators. In a pornographic culture, that problem is only going to get worse because the violence, the cruelty, the degradation that's so part of the core of the pornographic dynamic is more and more present, more and more part of the background in young people's lives. So it's not surprising, I think, to predict that we're going to see even a greater kind of invisibility of sexual violence in that pornographic culture.
Do we have any estimates at all of the number of men who consume pornography?
Well, jokingly, I always say that if you take a pornography consumer to mean somebody who has, at some point in his life has consumed pornography, the percentage of men in contemporary American culture who are porn consumers is roughly 100%, especially for younger people. It's simply a given. Unless someone grows up in a particular social or family situation in which that is unavailable to them, the assumption is, when I talk to young men, that they've all seen pornography. And when I ask, they all shrug and say, yes, of course, we've seen it. It doesn't mean all are avid consumers. But exposure to pornography in this culture right now, for younger people especially, is universal. Even men of my own age, I was born in 1958, exposure to pornography was pretty routine. The change, of course, has been both in the ease with which one can access pornography, and again, the intensity of the cruelty and degradation toward women, that has changed. So younger men, compared to men of my generation, have seen pornography, they tend to have seen more pornography, and they tend to have seen a more intensely brutal pornography. And that's the difference. And that's why I think many of us who have always been concerned about the domination and subordination that's so central to pornography are even more concerned than ever, given these social and technological changes.
Now, you did what we call academic research. What methodology did you use for your analysis mm-hmm. of pornography?
Well, one line of research on pornography has been out of psychology, very traditional experimental psychology, where you expose some group of people to a pornographic stimulus and others to a non-pornographic, and you try to use various measures of surveys about attitudes to find out what that might do. That line of research has been pursued for a number of years now, and from my point of view, produces very little in the way of reliable knowledge. There are certain questions that we simply have difficulty answering with much specificity. So the fundamental question that animated a lot of early research: does pornography use, especially the habitual use of the more brutal kinds of pornography, lead to increases in sexual violence? That's a question that I would say we don't know the answer to with any definitive certainty, and we probably never will, that the intellectual tools available to us probably aren't adequate to answer that question. So rather than continue to try and pursue that line of research, what I and others in the feminist camp have done is look at other ways to understand the phenomenon. So for instance, I did a series of in-depth interviews with both convicted sex offenders and self-identified pornography users to try and understand their experience. There's been a number of studies that have looked at women's experience, that is, women, especially women who are partnered with men who use pornography, what is their experience like? So trying to understand the effects of pornography on people's lives can be explored through conversation in a research setting, conversation that's systematic and detailed. Also looking at the content of pornography, I've done a series of studies over the last 10 years or so, just looking at a representative sample of the best selling and renting pornographic videos to try and chart trends in the presentation of sexuality in it. And that's where the trend is so clear, that the brutality, the cruelty and degradation toward women, and also, by the way, the overt racism in pornography is intensifying. Well, all of those things, I think, we have to approach with a certain kind of humility. We're never going to know the answers to some of these complex questions. Just like if you ask, what's the effect of a steady diet of violent television on young people? Well, it's a hard question to answer with much clarity, but we want to explore to the degree we can answer that question. And I think the evidence on pornography is quite clear that the trends in content are toward an ever-increasing cruelty and degradation, and that the effects of it are easy to see at some level. So the number of women, for instance, who report what the psychologists would call marital dissatisfaction, women in relationships with men who use pornography heavily, that's the evidence of that is mounting, both from psychologists and anecdotal evidence from divorce lawyers and therapists. So I think we can chart the trends, and I think there's a fair amount of research now which establishes those trends. The question is, what do we want to do about it? As a culture, do we want to engage in an honest discussion about how a very predatory corporate capitalist system has commodified, all of our lives down to the most intimate spaces of our lives, and done that in a patriarchal and white supremacist context, which means that those images that are being sold are not just any old images of sexuality. They're images of sexuality that degrade women and reinforce racism.
From your discussions with men and your observations of these pornographic materials, what would you say is the appeal to a man of pornography?
I've talked to many, many men over the last 20 years that I've worked on this and tried to examine my own experience, because I grew up in this culture too, and as a young man, a child, I had exposure to pornography as well. And I think one of the obvious things one can say is pornography gives men a sense of control. when you use a woman sexually through a pornographic media, you have control. Literally now with DVDs and the computer, the ability to fast forward, rewind, replay. Men's control of women sexually is complete in pornography, both in the way that men use it and in the images they're watching, because those images are overwhelmingly of men controlling women sexually. So that's one sense of appeal. But I also think we can look at a kind of deeper and perhaps more almost spiritual level in some sense and ask, what does it mean to live in a society in which we are, you know, defined as consumers, where everything is about consumption? And there, I think pornography as an issue is very useful, not just to point out the reality of the industry and what happens to the women in the industry, not just to look at the direct effects on people's lives, but also to ask, what kind of people are we becoming when those most basic of experiences, such as sexuality, and whatever one thinks about sexuality, it's core to who we are. I always think of sexuality as a kind of a form of communication. It's a way we try to understand ourselves, understand other people. Well, what happens when all of that is put into this commodified, mediated form? I think there's a lot we should think about in the way in which we've accepted in our lives so much of the commodification and mediation. What does it mean to be a human being when some of your most basic experiences you buy and experience through a screen? I think these are profound questions that we, again, have to engage.
When I was reading your descriptive material of actual porn films, I found it very emotionally grueling, in the same way that I find descriptions of torture at Abu Ghraib revolting. You comment on the cruelty of pornography. So is there any connection between pornography and other dimensions of war-making, economic misery, where women and children also are the main victims?
Yeah. Well, it is grueling to read those descriptions. And it was grueling to watch those films, I can tell you. And in fact, I've pretty much decided I'm going to no longer do this kind of research. The emotional toll is really quite extreme. A friend of mine joked once, he said, too bad you can't subcontract that work out to somebody who enjoys it. But of course, it's the enjoyment that keeps us from seeing the cruelty. And men often tell me, for instance, that I watch pornographic films and I don't see the kind of cruelty you're talking about. And of course, in some sense, they're being honest. They don't see it because that cruelty is being masked, being overwhelmed by the sexual pleasure. When we're engaged in sexual arousal and masturbation, which of course is the primary function of pornography, to facilitate masturbation for men, our critical faculties often do shut off. It's only when you step back and look at it in that more analytic style that you see that cruelty. And then it's overwhelming, I agree. And then I think the next step is, as you make, is very important to see the way that we accept cruelty in the culture in many, many ways. So for instance, you know, homelessness on the street, to take a very pertinent example. You can walk outside this studio and see people living on the street. Why do we accept that as a culture? There are lots of societies in human history where that would have been unthinkable. The way we wage war, the incredible barbarism of contemporary warfare. War is never pretty, of course, but we've developed weapons and a certain insulation from the effect of those weapons that allows a allegedly civilized society to destroy people in ways that are almost unthinkable. And of course, the most direct example, the torture, the way in which in the United States today, a significant portion of the U.S. population has accepted what the Bush administration likes to call, you know, extreme interrogation methods, which is, you know, a polite way of saying torture. There's been a backlash to it, but I was more struck by the way in which the dominant culture in the United States just kind of shrugged at those images from Abu Ghraib. Rush Limbaugh, the right-wing radio commentator, famously said, well, it's nothing more than a fraternity prank. And in a way, I think there was something important in what he said, because fraternity pranks are another way in which cruelty is institutionalized. Hazing is a form of torture, in a sense. So I think, again, the pornography issue and the connections you're making should lead us to step back and ask, what kind of society have we become? How has this domination-subordination dynamic, what we might think of as the inevitability of hierarchy and abuse. How much have we simply accepted that? How much are we, those of us in more privileged sectors of society, such as myself, for instance, how much have we become insulated from the human reaction to the suffering of others? In other words, to put it more bluntly, do we have, as a society, the capacity for empathy? Or have we lost our empathetic responses? And I think it's quite clear that when individually a person or collectively a culture no longer has the capacity for empathy, that is to see the suffering of another person and react to it as a human being, then it's hard to imagine how that society can survive very long, because that is the death of a human being, the death of empathy. And I think similarly, it's the death of a culture.
We've been speaking about places like the United States and Canada, and you made some reference to Europe. How do we know anything about the universality of this pornography consumption?
Well, what we do know from looking across the globe is that pornography consumption is primarily a first world phenomenon. That is, it is something that people with access to money do. So when you look not only at pornography, but all of the what I would call the sexual exploitation industries, prostitution, stripping, sex tourism, when affluent men go to, you know, the less developed parts of the world on sex tours, where you know your travel agent will book your hotel and your plane and your prostitutes. Well, those are industries made possible by the gross economic inequality in the world. You have people with the money to spend, and you have people who are desperate and in those industries. So when you look across the globe, and I don't pretend to be a cross-cultural expert, but when you just take a first look at it, pornography consumption is not surprisingly concentrated in North America, in Europe, in Japan, in places where men have that kind of disposable income. And the people who are in those industries tend to come from that sector of society, which is less economically stable and more desperate. So there's a lot of trafficking out of the third world, out of the former Soviet bloc. The patterns are pretty clear. And again, they are very much like the patterns that we see across the board economically. Where is sweatshop labor located? Well, it's not located in, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, outside of Harvard University, staffed by Harvard grads, right? I mean, it's all pretty simple. We're looking at the realities of not only capitalism, but an increasingly predatory capitalist system in which human beings are defined either as raw materials, inputs into production, or consumers and nothing else. And I think when I talk about pornography, and over the years this has intensified, I increasingly want to foreground the role of capitalism. It's not that there haven't been sexually explicit representations in other times and places in human history, but taking the representation of sex, turning it into a for-profit, mass-mediated commodity is really a function of the post-World War II era. What we call pornography, that is, this mass-mediated, mass-marketed enterprise, is really a product of the last 60 years. And I think we have to see it in that context and see it in the context of capitalism. And again, it's difficult to confront, but I think it raises very fundamental questions about the nature of the system we live in: patriarchal, white supremacist, capitalist, and imperial. That defines a very grim world. Pornography, for me, is one avenue into understanding that world. It's not the only one. It's not necessarily the most important one. But I would argue that the feminist critique of pornography is very much in line with a fundamental left critique of economic inequality, a fundamental left critique of first world imperialism, and the crucial critiques of white supremacy and patriarchy that should always be at the heart of how we see the world.
We haven't defined, and I haven't asked you to define, mm-hmm. pornography. In fact, in your book, you referred to the discussion about definition to be really a dodge from facing up to the reality of it. But those who defend pornography often use the question of definition. They use the question of it's natural, and they use the notion of it's erotic. It is part of the human imagination and sure. experience. How do you respond to all of those?
At some level, I agree. Sexuality is part of being human, and our creative impulses are part of being human. I can't imagine a world in which people were not sexual and not creative. But I think we can distinguish between the human desire to use our creative capacity to explore what is essentially the mystery of being human. And that's really what art does. Art explores those things that are beyond our rational faculties. I always say that's why there's so much art about sex and about God, because we don't understand either. People say, God, what do you know? Who knows what they're talking about, right? And so there's a lot of art that explores those things, and I think that's appropriate and healthy. I also think we can distinguish between that creative instinct in the human animal and an industry, a pornography industry, that's rooted in a white supremacist and patriarchal culture and commodifies everything, including that intimate dimension of our lives. Well, that industry produces a product. And while we may not be able to provide some, you know, bright line definition to distinguish between those gray areas in which sexual expression that is healthy morphs into pornography, which is destructive and degrading, I think for purposes of conversation, we can certainly distinguish between, let's say, a pornographic video in which five men sexually violate a woman using degrading terms and insults and, you know, like, this is not appropriate to go much further on the radio, of course. Can we not distinguish between that and love poems, you know, poems that explore sexual desire? I can distinguish between those. Now, when you start talking about legal solutions, public policy, then the definitional question gets much more important. But at this point in the book, I'm not proposing a law. I'm not suggesting that the primary way to deal with this is legal. When we write laws, we have to define terms. And in fact, part of what the law does is define terms through its application. So I think we can distinguish between social issues that we need to discuss, in which there need not be perfect clarity about a definition. For instance, for purposes of discussion that we might have, I would say, well, let's define pornography as those products the pornography industry identifies as pornography. Go on a website which says, we sell pornography. That's what I'm talking about, right? Let the industry define it. And at the same time, as we move into public policy discussions, we will have to refine and clarify those definitions. But that happens through discussion. My main concern about the definitional dodge, as I call it, is people want to use that dodge to shut down the conversation. And I think that's basically, from my point of view, fear-based. That we are, as a culture, afraid to ask, what can we learn about this society from pornography? What can we learn about the entrenched nature of white supremacy and patriarchy? What can we learn about the really corrosive nature of corporate capitalism from pornography? That discussion doesn't need specific definitions. It needs an honesty and a willingness to, quite frankly, look in the mirror and ask, who have we become?
Well, thank you for helping stimulate that reflection for all of us. And I certainly highly recommend your book to people to read.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Jensen's latest book is titled Getting Off: Pornography and the End of Masculinity.